Resisting the Attention Economy. Artist and author Jenny Odell's first book has a provocative title, How to Do Nothing. Odell is not talking about doing absolutely nothing, not sitting in a quiet room and staring at a wall all the time. Rather, she is encouraging people to resist, just a little, all those forces vying for your attention. You know, social media, your work email, advertising. Resist them, she argues, for at least part of each day. Doing so can be a radical act. I'm Jennifer Rooks. The New York Times describes Odell's book as a self-help manual that turns into a political manifesto. She weaves together thoughts on creativity, social theory, John Muir, communes, and bird watching, and argues that doing nothing is harder than we think. Have you made an effort to resist the attention economy? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Doing nothing. It sounds so easy, but when was the last time you consciously set about to do nothing? If you stopped being productive, even for a little while, did you feel guilty about it? My guest today is going to make the case for taking time to do nothing. Joining us from the studios of KQED in San Francisco is Jenny Odell, who teaches at Stanford University and is also a multidisciplinary artist and writer. She is the author of the new book, How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. Jenny Odell, welcome to Maine Calling.
Thanks for having me.
As always, we want to hear from you and the audience. Do you take the time to unplug? Do you worry about being productive? What does it mean to you to do nothing? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Jenny, as we just said, the title of the book is How to Do Nothing, but you don't really mean nothing, do you?
No, obviously I don't mean actually doing nothing. I mean nothing from the point of view of how we traditionally understand productivity. And so I think there's this kind of assumption that if time is money, then you need to be spending your time in a productive way that's worthwhile and that you know, gives you some sort of results that you can show at the end of that time. So really for me, nothing means anything that's not that. That could encompass, you know, anything from bird watching is my go-to example for myself, but any kind of observation, reflection, rest, care, you know, things like sleep. These are all things that we recognize are actually very important, maybe the most important parts of our lives sometimes, but they kind of aren't quite as easily articulated within this framework of obvious value or having something to show for your time.
You're pushing back against what you call the cult of productivity, that we're sort of been programmed to believe we have to be perpetually productive.
Yeah, and part of that is I grew up in Silicon Valley, so I feel like my whole life has been kind of steeped in that. But it's also not just, this idea that we need to be productive all the time, but it's also, I'm trying to push back against what we think productivity is and kind of ask the question, you know, productive of what and for whom and why. I think there's this kind of risk, both on the level of the individual, but also as a culture, of fetishizing a certain type of productivity and getting so kind of intensely focused on that we don't kind of look around and ask questions about the kind of larger direction that we're maybe going in. And that's something that I have, you know, thought about a lot as a visual artist. Anyone who makes anything, you know, who writes or makes things, or really anyone, I guess, could just tell you that there are times when it appears that you are doing nothing, but you're actually, you know, that might be the most important part of something like an artistic process. I always tell my students in the art class that I teach to give themselves twice as much time as they think they need, because a lot of that time isn't going to feel like or look like making anything. So it's also, you know, the cult of productivity, it's a certain type of productivity. And I'm kind of trying to zoom out from that a little bit and think about, you know, other ways of valuing different kinds of activities.
Sure, there's sort of a catch-22 here, isn't there, though, because a lot of people will be encouraged to seek mindfulness or maybe go on a run or something like that, because that will help your brain become more productive.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really great point. And I kind of try to set out early on in the book this point that this is not meant to be a sort of weekend digital detox retreat kind of situation where you go back to work on Monday refreshed and ready to be more productive, that I actually want to deeply question what is productive. And, you know, I've been warning people, this is not only not a self-help book, but you might actually feel more confused leaving it than when you went in. And that I personally think that's a good thing. And so, yeah, it's a fine line, right? It's like mindfulness as life hack versus like actually deeply questioning things that might, the answering of which might take you a really long time and actually be deeply troubling.
And you say in the beginning of the book that you don't have the answers, that writing this book is part of a, I'm doing air quotes here, part of a journey, if you will.
Yeah. And that's partially just because that's how I work. As an artist, I've always, I'm not a sort of make something from scratch type of artist. A lot of my work is recontextualizing things. You know, for example, when I was an artist in residence at the dump, you know, my project wasn't, you know, making trash into sculptures. It was just simply researching the manufacturing origins and stories behind the objects. So that's kind of my style, to kind of, you know, get a big pile of stuff and kind of arrange it in a way that might make some sort of maybe novel argument. But it's certainly not kind of like a blank slate that I'm making this, you know, hard and fast argument on. And that's also, I think, you know, part of the argument of the book. I talk later on about this model of the ecological self, which is almost like the opposite of a personal brand. It's this acknowledgement that your identity is actually quite fluid and subject to the different influences and people and ideas around you. And that's kind of constantly changing. And so I really mean my book to be just a part of that dialogue, and the book itself arose out of something similar.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about that. How did this book arise? It's not necessarily what you would think.
No, it's not. And there's kind of there's like the long buildup and then there's like the short one. The overall background, I think, is just, you know, that I'm an artist and I've been teaching art to non-art majors for a long time at Stanford. And just being in this culture, you know, as an artist who doesn't, quote unquote, make anything or doesn't make anything that looks obviously like art, I have long been in a position of having to advocate for these kind of less obvious forms of or less obvious types of value and the value of kind of just like thinking and reflection and holding that open against the pressures of needing to have something to show for every single minute that you spent. So that's kind of been a long ongoing thing. And then more immediately, there was sort of a moment in late 2016, kind of between the election and the Ghost Ship fire, which was a fire in a warehouse in Oakland where I live, that quite a few people died in, some of whom were friends of friends, and many of whom were artists. And so I was observing kind of both in myself and the people around me this kind of... two things at the same time. Like, one was the sort of abusive relationship to social media and kind of the news cycle in general. And then the other one was this kind of, it felt like in the moment paralysis. In retrospect, I realized it was just that I needed time to reflect. But, you know, we're so kind of unused to that idea of being able to step away and do something like reflect that it registers as paralysis, right? And you feel guilty about it. And so I was just observing that, and also observing that I had started going to a rose garden about 5 minutes away from my apartment in Oakland and just sitting and doing nothing, almost involuntarily and quite often. And this is winter, so there's no roses in the rose garden. And so really what came out of that was a talk that I gave at a conference the following year called How to Do Nothing. And that conference, it's called I.O., it's in Minneapolis, tends to have a lot of makers in the audience. But I don't think, you know, I don't think this argument is only applicable to people who make things, but that's kind of who I originally wrote the talk for, is, you know, someone else who might be feeling the same way, the same kind of paralysis. So that, you know, it was originally a talk. I ended up putting it online. I was very surprised by the response to that from, you know, all different types of people. And so that kind of, that's the seed of what turned into the book. And it's actually, chapter one is basically that talk.
Mm. You talked a couple minutes ago about questioning what and who are we productive for. And I think the example you give in the book of Old Survivor is a really great example. Can you tell our audience about Old Survivor?
Sure. Yeah. So Old Survivor is a tree in the Oakland Hills. It's our last surviving old growth redwood. So it's kind of crazy to think about now. But in the Oakland Hills, we used to have an old growth redwood forest similar to what you would find kind of further up north in California now. And those are like, you know, some of the biggest trees ever. And we lost all of those to logging in the 19th century. And it was assumed that they were all gone. But at some point, I think in the 60s, somebody kind of came across Old Survivor, as it was named. And this tree had survived because it was a little bit hard to get to. And it was also kind of an odd shape and not actually that tall compared to an old growth redwood. Of course, now it's very tall compared to all the second and third growth redwoods. And I was really struck by the story and even images of it where you can kind of see it standing on this rocky outcrop because it sounded to me like the real life version of a Taoist story that I had just come across called The Useless Tree, which is in the story is an oak tree, but it's basically a story of a carpenter who comes across a large, very gnarled oak tree and kind of disdainfully remarks that it's only gotten that big because it's useless for timber. So it's basically a story of someone who can only see something as a certain type of material for extraction and for use. And so he calls it, you know, useless. And then he goes to sleep and the tree comes to him in a dream and says, "Who are you to call me useless? You're a mortal man about to die. Meanwhile, uselessness has been very useful for me. I'm still alive." So it's kind of this like the punchline is that, you know, uselessness and usefulness, it really depends on the frame in which you're looking at them from. And the joke of that story is sort of zooming out and it's like, oh, right. There are all these other forms of usefulness. For instance, the fact that the story mentions the tree is so big that it shades all these teams of oxen and horses. So it's quite useful as giving care. It's useless as timber, but that's actually been very useful for the tree.
Mm-hmm. We've talked about what you mean by doing nothing in The Cult of Productivity. I want to talk about the subtitle of the book. You write, "Resisting the Attention Economy." What is the attention economy?
So I will say that I didn't coin that term, so it probably depends on who you ask. For me, I sort of define the attention economy literally as the design of technology, and particularly social media, but also things like headlines and whatnot. Just kind of anything that's designed specifically with an eye toward human psychology, you know, and addictive tendencies, something that's designed to keep you, say, on a social media platform and as engaged as possible, both, you know, for reasons of advertising to you, selling data, et cetera. And so that's kind of the literal answer. I think there's also, you know, within the idea of the attention economy, I also include phenomena like personal branding, things where you're sort of... it's imagined that every person is sort of a brand and an entrepreneur in a way and constantly needs to be participating in this economy, constantly kind of making their experiences into these products and constantly expressing oneself in a way that's dictated by these platforms. So that's a little bit less, you know, literal in terms of design, but I think that's something that comes out of those designs.
You know, what struck me thinking about what you're writing about is that a lot of this isn't new. It has a new dimension because of the internet and social media, but the adage, "time is money," is attributed to Ben Franklin.
Right. Yeah. And that's actually something I've been currently researching since publishing the book is, you know, that goes all the way back to even, you know, Puritanism, where it's immoral to waste the time that you're given, where it's sort of imagined that, you know, God gave you a bank that has time in it. And are you spending it wisely? And are you improving yourself? And then not to mention, you know, just processes of industrialization. So it really goes quite far back. And then things even like the attention economy, I mean, advertising, as long as we've had advertising, that's also a form of the attention economy. So these things are certainly not new. I think they're very ramped up right now. I would say the difference is that it feels maybe more granular because of, you know, the fact that you have this thing in your pocket all the time, and the way that it sort of interrupts all of your activities, including sleeping for some people, all throughout the day. It feels like it's just kind of metastasized a little bit throughout everything else, whereas maybe before it was a bit more contained.
Jenny, why do you think it's so important to resist? What is the attention economy doing to us individually and as a society?
I think it's doing a lot of things. And the ones that I'm the most concerned about individually, you know, as someone, again, as an artist and a person who's just always been very curious, and I like, you know, sounds kind of silly, but I like looking at things. It's like my favorite thing to do is just look at stuff. I dislike the attention economy because it's taking me away from something that I like, that I value. I mean, I think I'm one of those people who believes that you really don't have to look at or think about anything for very long before it turns out to be very strange. And I think that just being alive and other forms of life are quite fascinating. And a lot of the book, you know, is about my love of ecology and learning about different species in this area. And so that's something that I really deeply love and something that makes me feel alive because I'm surprised. It's something I don't know. It's how I know that today is not yesterday. And so just kind of being pulled along by that, that's, you know, I live for that literally. And so anything that's kind of distracting me from that, not to mention distracting me from, you know, interactions with people I love, you know, it doesn't get any more meaningful than that. And so, that's what I worry about on kind of an individual level. And also being able to reflect. I mean, we have access to so much information. A lot of my work as an artist has been with things, you know, online, but, you know, at the same time that I love having access to that, I also need to have time to be able to process that and turn that into something like understanding. So that's what I worry about on the individual level. On the collective level, I worry a lot about, you know, the amount of communication and focus, collective focus that it takes to do something like organize or, you know, create any kind of movement. You know, it takes coordination for a body, an individual body to move. And so I think it also takes coordination for a social body to move. And one of the questions that I ask towards the end of the book is, you know, what if we took all of the energy that we spend kind of shouting into this void and trying to package our messages in a way that they'll be heard over this clamor? What if we just took that energy and put it into saying the things that we need to say to the people we need to say them to at a particular time?
And that is the second part of your message. It's not just opting out of the attention economy, but also opting in to other things.
Right. I mean, I think it's sort of unreasonable to ask somebody to disengage from something that's as addictive as the attention economy by design, and not give them something else to pay attention to, or at least not suggest a direction. And so I think, you know, it's not a complicated argument. If you think about the times that you don't feel distracted, you know, for instance, by your phone, but even just kind of the idea of that whole world that's existing on your phone, there are often times when you recognize that you're experiencing something meaningful, like something that you think you might never see again, or you're having an in-person conversation with an old friend. Like, it's not a coincidence that those are the times when this is not so much of an issue.
I want to talk a little bit more about opting into nature, public spaces, community, but we're going to take a quick break. We're talking with author and artist Jenny Odell. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MainCalling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Lamy Wellahan Shoes, helping Maine students attend college in their home state through the annual Maine Difference Scholarship. More at lwshoes.com. And Maine State Music Theater, presenting Duke Ellington's Sophisticated Ladies, June 5th through the 22nd. Tickets at msmt.org.
A Justice Department report found Alabama's prisons have the highest homicide rate in the nation. One inmate in that system heard our coverage and wrote us a letter. He says inmates have never felt so unsafe.
We never just felt like our life being in danger the way it is today. Basically, everybody incarcerated feels in danger.
A view from inside Alabama's prisons this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening here on Maine Public Radio. The Maine Public News Tell Me More tour is underway as Maine Public News travels the state to hear directly from you and learn what you feel are the most important issues in your community and how Maine Public News can best serve you and keep you informed. Our Brunswick event is now filled up, but we're also headed to Augusta this Thursday evening. It starts at 5:30 p.m. at the Governor Hill Mansion at 136 State Street. Senior news editor Keith Shortall, along with the State House political reporter Steve Missler, will be on hand to discuss stories and issues being covered. For more information about all the Tell Me More tour visits, please visit mainpublic.org and click on Events or the banner ad.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. This is Maine Calling. Today on the program, author Jenny Odell is on the line with us. Her new book is How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll get to the calls in just a minute, but I want to return to what we were talking about before the break, which was what to be opting into, what is more meaningful personally and for society. And Jenny, you're a bird watcher. I know a lot of our listeners are bird watchers, avid bird watchers, as we do our programs on bird watching. They're some of our most popular. What is it about birds that takes us away from the modern world?
I think that, you know, bird watching, whether intentional or not, right? Like sometimes you haven't set out to watch birds, but you get lucky anyway. It's sort of the opposite of, if you think about your state of mind when, say, you've been on Twitter for an hour, or even when you're Googling something, right? It's like you have this kind of like aggressive need for an answer or a product or something like that that never seems to be satiated. But it's this very sort of like, yeah, aggressive, forward-leaning feeling and very goal-oriented. And I find that bird watching is the opposite of that, because as anyone who goes bird watching knows, you know, it's not in your control. You may see something, you may not. You don't know what you're going to see. I mean, I've been so surprised so many times. I was just in Point Reyes over the weekend, and I saw a baby owl, you know, and I only saw it because I realized that I was trying to get to the ocean, and I realized it was too late, so I needed to turn back. And I was disappointed about that. But if I hadn't turned back at that time, I wouldn't have seen it. And so I always have this funny feeling whenever I'm surprised like that, that I was standing in the exact right time at the exact right place, right? There's this, you know, I mean, all animals are on the move, but there's something about a bird because it appears out of nowhere and then it can suddenly disappear. And so while it's there, you kind of, time stops and you have to just, you know, it's like I won't move until it leaves because I don't know how long it's going to be there. And so I just find that it's like the polar opposite of the mentality that is kind of pushed on us a lot of the time.
So I'm assuming you don't have a life list as a bird watcher.
No, I'm a very not goal-oriented bird watcher.
Well, so I'm going to go to Chris, who's calling from East Machias. Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. There was a 19th century preacher which said a small object held close enough to the eye can block out the entire ocean. And the poet Denise Levitov wrote, "Ordinary and mysterious this day like all days." And if we're staring at a screen all the time, we're missing out on the mysterious, which I believe is here. It's all around us. We just have to look for it. And I do concur with your speaker, because one of the high points of my day is looking out the window and watching the birds come to my beak. Peter, thank you very much.
Chris, thanks for your call. Jenny, thoughts?
That's so lovely. I mean, it's one of the great things about having written this book is that I get to hear that, you know, I'm not crazy. And that, you know, actually a lot of people sort of recognize the importance of this. And it's just because, you know, it's not this loud thing that you proclaim all the time. It doesn't, you know, feel quite as visible. But I think that a lot of people have different ways of being in that kind of mindset. I just talked to someone recently who said that he was not good at doing nothing, but then would watch his cat watching birds out the window, and that he sort of learned from the cat how to look out the window. And so I think, you know, I also think it's not a coincidence that that animals, watching animals, or, you know, even plants, right, just other forms of life, makes it easier for us to kind of step out of this really myopic, very human-centered, and also very kind of goal-directed way of thinking that, you know, animals, you know, we think we know them, but they're quite unpredictable, and the ways that they act are, you know, for very different types of reasons. And so just even watching an animal, I find to be really enchanting.
Chris, thanks for your call. We're going to move to Ellery, who's calling from Waterville. Hi, Ellery. Go ahead.
Hello. Again, another great show. Thank you. Quick comment and question. I frequently try to do nothing. In fact, I think it's one of the things I do best. But however, I often find myself slipping into thinking. Now, so my question is, how does one really know when they're doing nothing by, you know, clearing the mind or just not focusing on something? How do you know when you've reached that state? I can't tell.
That is a great question. I think that for me, the answer has to do with the difference between judgment and observation. So one of the artists that I talk about in the book is Pauline Oliveros, who was a sound artist and composer. And she had this practice that she called deep listening. And deep listening was basically listening to everything that was possible for you to listen to, both outwardly and inwardly. And she specifically said that she intended that as a kind of antidote for the mindset that we're taught, which is needing to make judgments or analyzing or, you know, having a reaction or something like that. And so she made that difference very clear. And that difference has been very helpful for me. I have noticed that if I have nothing else planned, if I'm lucky enough to have a whole day, my solo hike tends to, for whatever reason, always end up being about 5 hours. And I've noticed that for the first hour, I feel like I'm not quite there yet. Maybe that's the thinking part of it. I'm maybe not expressly thinking about work that I need to do or something like that. I'm not Instagramming, but there is this still sort of kind of monologue going in my head about, you know, myself being there and maybe that, like, you know, just things about myself or still sort of analytical type of thought. And then at some point, maybe like an hour and a half into it, it just changes into like just observation, almost like I went away and I've been replaced with just the things that I'm observing. And it's almost as if you asked me, like, where were you during those next 4 hours? I wouldn't be able to answer you. And so I think, that's like my favorite kind of state of being. And so it feels like a very sort of self-ego effacing, just observation of things around me without analysis or judgment, just kind of like letting everything in.
You know, it seems, Jenny, as there's so many things sort of that are trends right now in our society that kind of come together in sync with what you're thinking about. You know, there's been a lot of coverage of the whole idea of nature bathing, I guess, which is from Japan, but also the maker movement, which is really strong here in Maine, and I'm certain in California as well. Do you sense that there's some kind of change underway?
I think it's hard to say. I think it's really interesting that we're in this moment where it's become a commonplace to, you know, sort of hate on social media. Or, you know, you have a lot of people saying things like, oh, you know, I wish I could, you know, something as simple as like, look at my phone less, or just like, I wish I could live my life differently, or I know these things are important, but I don't make time for them. So even my students, you know, I've noticed within the last couple of years, they're very, you know, this is something they think about a lot, even as they find themselves subject to it. Like, they can talk about things like the attention economy and they understand it, but they still are still kind of participating in it and finding it hard to pull out of that. So I don't know if that means that, I don't know where that's going, but I do think it's definitely remarkable that we find ourselves in that kind of odd in-between moment.
And you haven't completely cut yourself off from social media, have you?
No, I haven't. I've just become very wary and sort of more intentional, hopefully, about how I use it. You know, speaking of an in-between time, my book is sort of written to address this moment in which I at the end, imagine a sort of utopian social network, which is like a non-commercial, decentralized, open source kind of thing, which we have, you know, smaller kind of models of right now. And that would be really great, right, to imagine a social media that doesn't ask you to be on it all the time, like a social media that was just a tool where people shared information like a bulletin board and shared jokes and kept in touch and all of that stuff. However, you know, we don't have anything right like that right now that's super widespread. And so in the sort of meantime between now and that ideal that I hold out, I sort of advocate for, you know, still participating. I mean, you don't have to. A lot of people have left social media and it's probably great for them, but not everyone can or wants to. And so I sort of advocate for participating in what I call the wrong way. So you're still a user, but you're not using it in the ways that it sort of wants you to use it. An example would be a Chrome plugin that I have called the Facebook Newsfeed Eradicator, which simply removes your newsfeed. I still have Facebook because it's how I find out about a lot of events and, you know, have a lot of relatives on there. But this makes it so that if I need to remember the time or address of an event, I just go and I get that information and I leave. And I'm not like sucked into this wormhole of auto-playing videos that I never asked to see.
We have a question from Nikki. How is doing nothing different from watching TV or reading a novel?
I think that, well, reading a novel is really great. I don't want to seem like anti-technology and favoring the novel over TV. I guess, I think it, for me, it has to do with a kind of, it's like there's an active quality about this observation I'm talking about. If you're bird watching, for example, it's passive in that you're not kind of making anything or producing or anything or trying to achieve anything, but it's very active in that you have to pay a lot of attention. It's hard. I mean, it's something you have to, maybe not hard, but it's an effort, right? Like it's an effort that you have to make to be open enough to see these things. I mean, this is something I've learned personally. It's very humbling. In the last couple of years, as I've gotten better and more attentive, I've just simply seen more and different kinds of birds because I'm paying better attention. And so I think it's this strange balance between the passiveness of not making judgments and not needing to produce anything and being open to what's there, but an active kind of attention. And I think there are some forms of media, like, I mean, it depends on what you're watching on TV, right? But some things on TV, you're just totally passive. Like you're passive, you're receiving the information and you're passive in that, you know, you're just sort of engaging with it like the way that you're being asked to engage with it.
We're going to take another quick break. We're talking with author and artist Jenny O'Dell. Our phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address is talk@mainpublic.org. You can ask your question via tweet @MainCalling or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Main Calling possible, as do Black Cow Burgers and Fries, a cocktail bar and soda fountain on Exchange Street in Portland, with dine-in or takeout service. BlackCowBurgers.com. And St. Mary's Health System Orthopedics, helping patients live their best lives in motion. Online at findabonedoctorme.org.
Coming up on the next Commonwealth Club program, David Gergen, who advised four American presidents going back to Richard Nixon, says that climate change is turning out exactly the way scientists predicted, with one exception. It's happening faster than they thought. Join us for conversations with Gergen, journalist Marianne Lavelle, and Republican pollster Lori Weigel about the intersection of politics and the changing environment on the next Commonwealth Club radio program.
That's coming up in just a few minutes at 2 o'clock right here on Maine Public Radio. June is Music That Moves Me Month here on Maine Public Radio. With the support of the Maine Community Foundation and Verrill Dana, a key component of this effort is our previously loved used instrument collection drive. We're collecting used instruments for deserving young musicians across our state. If you have an instrument or two collecting dust somewhere in the recesses of your attic, closet, or cellar, please consider donating it. And it's easy. Stop by our Portland, Bangor, or Lewiston offices and drop them off. For more information, visit mainpublic.org and click on the banner or on events. Thanks.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the case for being unproductive, at least for a little while. Joining me, Jenny O'Dell, who teaches at Stanford University. She is also a multidisciplinary artist and writer based in Oakland, California. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times, SF Momo's Open Space, McSweeney's, and more. We're talking about her new book, How to Do Nothing. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Jenny, I'm wondering if writing this book, if going on this exploration, has changed your art.
That's a great question. I can't tell yet, because I haven't made any art since then. I mean, true to How to Do Nothing, right? I've done nothing.
Except teach at Stanford, right?
Right. Yeah. No. And I teach full time, so it's actually a lot. I will say there is an interesting parallel between the way that I make art and the way that I wrote the book. You know, some people who know my artwork kind of were asking at the time, like, is it hard to kind of shift your mind over to just writing? And it actually didn't feel like a shift at all, because a lot of my previous projects have had a lot of writing in them. So the project that I mentioned at the dump, that's basically like a giant book of photos of these things that I found in the dump, with these really long written descriptions of all of the information I was able to find about them. And prior to that, I made a lot of collages using imagery from Google Earth. So when I look at the process that I use for the book, it's like, you know, this long process of collecting little bits and pieces from different sources. And, you know, this book is really, like, in terms of sources, all over the place. And then I would literally write, you know, those things out on cards and arrange them on a table or on the floor, which is almost a form of collage. So in terms of, like, the process and maybe, like, the parts of my brain that were lighting up, it actually didn't feel that different. And what I can see right now is that I left the book thinking a lot about that kind of time is money and why is time money and when did that happen? And I found that I've been thinking about, you know, the possibility of doing visual art projects around that. So I think it's this kind of nice thing where, you know, an idea kind of gets, like, kicked back and forth between these two different disciplines that ultimately don't feel that different to me.
We have an email from David. He writes, "Our attention to social media is a resource and driver of growth for our economy. As with any resource, there's only so much attention to go around. What is going to happen to our economy when there's no more attention to be stolen? Or, as I hope, what happens to our economy if we all decide we'd rather sit quietly?"
I would love to know what would happen in that case. You know, it's like, in a way, the next worst thing to everyone quitting Facebook would be everyone staying on it, but just not using it in the way that they were supposed to, right? Like, just checking in and then leaving. I'm not sure. I'm a little bit, when I look back at the history of something like advertising, or even, you know, for other projects, I've looked at the history of fraud in the U.S., you see this kind of arms race almost, where it's like there's such, you know, as long as we live in capitalism, there's going to be this force that will want to appropriate things and want to capitalize on them, whether that's, you know, experience, attention, your idea of selfhood. And there will always be people working on that, on how to do that. And so, you know, like my book is one, you know, little push from the other side. But I think whatever new ways we may find to kind of try to evade that, like, you'll see other, you know, kind of innovations coming from the other side. It seems sort of pessimistic, but I think it's related to my idea on the individual level that, you know, this is an ongoing thing. This isn't like you, certainly for me writing the book, but even, you know, someone reading the book isn't going to have an answer at the end that will solve the attention economy problem for them forever. It's more sort of suggesting a type of attitude and mentality that you can use to sort of, like, negotiate this, but it'll be an ongoing kind of daily thing.
You know, we've talked a little bit about this idea of the cult of productivity, but I want to bring up another idea, and that is this idea that of civic responsibility. You know, we're having this conversation on a radio station that mainly brings us the news, and it brings us the news all day long, news and conversation. And a lot of people feel, a lot of our listeners feel as though it's their civic responsibility to be well informed. Yet that goes against this. By being well informed, one is being productive and not, you know, allowing oneself to let the attention wander. And I'm wondering if that's something you've thought about as you explore this idea.
Yeah, it definitely is. And I really want to recommend an article. Unfortunately, I don't remember the name of the author. I think it was in The Guardian. And the headline is something like, "How the News Overtook Reality." And it really kind of, it's a more satisfying answer to this question than anything I provide in the book. And I was really struck by it. And they make this point that the idea that kind of staying up on the news all the time and that being part of civic responsibility comes from a time when information was more scarce and of a different quality than what we have now. So it comes from a certain context, but now you have a situation where you have, news, but you also have kind of information disguised as news some of the time that is packaged in a way to basically just drive advertising dollars and use your attention as a resource. And so that kind of complicates that original idea of civic responsibility. And something that I mentioned at some point in the book is that I actually took an inspiration from Thomas Merton, who was a hermit in the mid-20th century, who wrote a lot about social issues and political issues. And he says this, or he articulates it as, it's not a question of whether to participate, but how. And I find that very useful. So, I'm certainly not advocating for like suddenly ignoring the news or moving to the middle of nowhere. But I think it is helpful to kind of step back and ask, okay, how am I engaging with the news? What is the sort of landscape of this news that I'm engaging with? And give yourself the time and space to see context around events and things, because the way social media is right now, it's not going to give you that time. It wants you to kind of keep coming back and keep refreshing and stay in this sort of like heightened state of anxiety all the time, because that's very profitable for a company like that. So it's sort of not whether, but how.
And our producer notes that the author of the Guardian article is Oliver Berkeman. So we're going to post that on our Facebook page and web page for people who would like to read it. So thanks, Jenny. One thing that struck me about your book is how you've connected a lot of things that I know a lot of us are thinking about, whether we're thinking about mindfulness or whether we're thinking about the impact of social media on our life or whether we're thinking about climate change and the environmental crises we face. And you see these as all part of a whole. And I want to see if you can talk about that a little bit and how you relate one to the other.
Sure. I think I maybe came across that connection a little bit unexpectedly because when I wrote the talk, How to Do Nothing, that was largely about social media and sort of beginning to think about the values of doing something like quote unquote nothing. But it really wasn't until I was researching the rest of the book that I fully brought in this ecological component, part of which is coming from me as a person who has lived in the Bay Area for my entire life, finally learning about what is right in front of me and has been right in front of me for my entire life, which is a very humbling experience. And so as I was kind of, for my own purposes, learning, the names of things and learning how things grow and learning about this ecological community and about bioregionalism, I started to be really struck by certain parallels or certain connections, some of which are metaphorical and some of which I think are more concrete. For instance, something like if you look at what happens to an ecological community that gets overtaken by some sort of like invasive species and becomes this monoculture. There's something that I see in common between that process and what happens to sort of the self as imagined in the attention economy and in this cult of productivity and in how information is circulated, contextless information that moves very quickly but doesn't kind of have any roots anywhere. And so I think even in the beginning, I compare, the way information and identity is imagined online as like a Monsanto farm as compared to, a thriving and biodiverse ecology. So some of it is just like an incidental kind of parallel that I saw using one to talk about the other. But I think they are also connected in that this idea of needing to insist on something like doing nothing, which is not, it's something sort of too ambiguous to be fully articulated in a sort of purely capitalist framework. There's there's something that that also has in common with how we imagine, say, like an ecological community, like what is useful, right? So if you have a very narrow version of usefulness, you get the Monsanto farm because that's considered productive. You're producing this thing that's very obvious, which is food. But meanwhile, you're actually destroying the soil. So from a slightly larger point of view, it's very unproductive. And so I think that's, you know, this the way that we imagine what usefulness is a problematic, whether it's applied to life and experience or something like land use and what is useful in a community.
We have an email from Inga. I'm a high school English teacher and a mom of an 8 and 15-year-old. It's interesting to observe the busy natures of schools as an institution that I work in, but also through the eyes of my own children and their feelings about school. Schools in general are swamped by and overrun with manic activity, high output of products, and a blind allegiance to standards and quantifying everything in measurable parts. Gone are the days of simple experiences and observing things just for the sake of going more slowly and watching things. And that's why schools can be such a hard place for hard places for introverted children and teens. I love how Jenny is making us look at these topics in a fresh and affectionate way. Way to go. So thank you for that from Inga. And it's interesting to me, Jenny, that you're what Inga's saying about schools. I mean, the students that you're teaching at Stanford are the kids who rose to the top of these schools and were able, you know, able to navigate the maze that is modern life better than anyone else.
Right. Yeah, it's actually interesting. I'm now thinking about, you know, I went to a public school in Cupertino, but the school had a pretty high acceptance rate into schools like Stanford. And it was absolutely the situation that person just described. And I have journals going back, you know, to that time where I complain about the amount of work that we're given, the sort of like mindless busy work. And I have all these descriptions of, which is very funny in retrospect, of me like staring out the window at the Santa Cruz Mountains and just like wishing that I could go look at trees or something. And apparently I was very into the quote, I think it's Mark Twain, "I never let my schooling interfere with my education," was like apparently a favorite quote of mine as a teenager. So I remember that. And then, yeah, now I'm getting the students that kind of come out at the other end of that. And so it's been, yeah, a challenge for me to kind of create some sort of like bubble that holds the space against that kind of environment. And in this bubble, you have things like experimentation and surprise and, you know, trying something that you don't know the outcome and you're not supposed to know the outcome, that is not formulaic. And I just have to share that there was a really amazing moment in my class the other day. It's a digital art class where one of my students had used a microscope camera to make this amazing kind of like abstract video piece. But he also had this folder on his desktop that everyone wanted to look at that was just random images that he had taken with his microscope camera of like paprika, of like some hair, like an ant. And he was just going through all of them and everyone was just like squealing or like screaming or like, and like they were like, yeah, we want to see your skin, you know? And it was just this like really amazing moment where I was like, you know, it's sad that what this reminds me of is elementary school. It shouldn't remind me of elementary school. It should remind me of like all of school, right? And so I think it is kind of it is unfortunate that that seems to be increasing, at least from what I can tell. But it was already an issue when I was in school. And so I'm really trying to create something that's like the opposite of that.
Well, Jenny, that's going to be our last question. We're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us today. That is Jenny Odell. She teaches at Stanford University. We're talking about her new book, How to Do Nothing. Nikki Shields ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as helpful links and resources at mainecalling.org. Today's program will be rebroadcast again tonight at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.